7:30 on This West Virginia Morning, I'm Beth Voorhees. Plants, animals, fish, and insects are invading, and state officials need your help to get rid of them. The story coming up on This West Virginia Morning. State natural resources officials are working on a plan to wipe out these invasive species in West Virginia. Glynis Board reports.
When we talk about invasive species in West Virginia, we're talking about everything from feral cats and hogs to gypsy moths to viral hemorrhagic septicemia, or VHS, a highly contagious fish pathogen. These alien species, which cause economic or environmental harm or harm to human health, are outlined in the 2014 draft West Virginia Invasive Species Strategic Plan. It's a voluntary environmental guideline. Conservation planner with the West Virginia DNR, Whitney Bailey, explains while there are several invasive species management plans throughout the state, this is the first statewide encompassing plan of its kind.
The West Virginia Invasive Species Strategic Plan is designed to provide a conceptual and organizational framework for all agencies and organizations in West Virginia who deal with invasive species to move forward on the same page. And it helps align local efforts with federal guidelines, federal priorities, et cetera, and with what other states and regional efforts are doing.
Bailey says this framework is already enabling organizations to collaborate. The Potomac Highlands Cooperative Weed and Pest Management Area and the Division of Highways sat down to talk about how to manage the especially aggressive invasive plant called Japanese knotweed.
So we were able to partner with them and give them technical expertise and control recommendations, and then they were able to give us access to lands along the highway where control measures could be implemented more effectively.
The draft plan points out that there are more than 450 invasive non-native insect pests living in the state. A handful are well-known, like the gypsy moth, emerald ash borer, hemlock woolly adelgid, and especially hard to miss these days, the brown marmorated stink bug. Fights against pathogens and threats to aquatic species are also active and ongoing. And of course, there are invasive plant species. It's daunting. But Bailey explains what's more daunting is where we would be if we did nothing. Right now, we live in one of the most biodiverse regions of North America. Bailey likens our understanding of biodiversity to our understanding of DNA. We recognize all the parts, she says, but we're only just beginning to understand the roles each element plays. Bailey says our wild and wonderful home affords us protections we don't fully appreciate, and invasive species threaten that diversity.
A lot of these invasive plants really decrease biodiversity, which in turn decreases the quality of the habitat for all the organisms that depend on it. You know, I liken it to, you know, you grow up in a neighborhood with, you know, Kroger and Walmart and all these big, you know, shopping centers and grocery stores, and then you wake up one day and there's nothing but 7-Eleven. So it's like, you know, yeah, there's some resources there, but you'll die of malnutrition.
According to the draft of the Invasive Species Strategic Plan, annual losses due to invasive species in the U.S. have been estimated at over $127 billion. This amount includes damages to crops and pastures, forest losses, damage from insect and other invertebrate pests, human diseases, control costs, and even loss of residential value. It affects everyone. That's why the DNR is looking for input from everyone. Citizen groups, watershed societies, land trusts, hunters, farmers. All feedback is welcome. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
State natural resources officials will accept comments on the draft plan by mail or email through October 22nd. Visit us online at wvpublic.org for more details. This is West Virginia Morning. It's coming up on 7:35. A frost advisory is in effect until 9 o'clock this morning for northeastern West Virginia. There's some dense fog this morning, clearing away for mostly sunny skies, temperatures in the 60s and low 70s. Some fog tonight with lows in the 40s, mostly sunny Wednesday and Thursday with temperatures in the 70s.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by the New River Gorge Regional Development Authority, working to diversify the economy in the New River Gorge region of West Virginia, serving Fayette, Nicholas, Raleigh, and Summers counties. NRGRDA.org.
In Charleston, those who grew up during segregation remember a tight-knit community in the downtown neighborhood known as The Block. During the 1930s and 40s, Barbara Hicks Lacey grew up in this neighborhood and is one of the remaining residents who vividly recalls The Block, which today has all but disappeared. The West Virginia Center for African American Culture and Arts recently invited her to share her story at the West Virginia State Archives. Roxy Todd reports.
When I was in high school, everything was really segregated.
When she was a kid, Barbara Hicks Lacey's best friend, named Baby Sue, was white, and so they weren't allowed to attend the same school. The Block was full of characters, and during segregation, she saw many well-to-do black tourists and musicians who came through her neighborhood.
Particularly when the rhythm and blues people were coming to town and there was going to be a dance.
Lacey worked at her father's restaurant, the Block Cafe. She explained that she got to meet a lot of these people because the restaurants in the Block were the only place where non-whites were allowed to eat, and they had to stay at the Ferguson or the Brown Hotel. Here, it was safe for children to roam around the neighborhood together, and that meant Lacey was free to, well, express herself in many ways. She told one story about a bar owned by Mr. Penn. She doesn't think her mother ever found out that often as a little kid, Lacey would stop by Mr. Penn's bar to perform a song or two. She had it in her mind that she was an undiscovered Shirley Temple. Mr. Penn would lift her up onto the bar, and Lacey would sing.
And I'd sing, "Nighttime is the right time."
She earned a quarter for singing at the beer joint. That quarter was usually spent down the street at the Ferguson Theater, where Lacey said she spent almost every afternoon after school watching movies.
That's what we did, all the kids in the neighborhood. We went to the movie every day.
But these movies were basically the same films that were shown at the White Theater. Separated by a few blocks, during segregation, downtown Charleston essentially was split into two sides, roughly along Washington Street. Garnett High School was the local black school, about a block away from Lacey's father's cafe. As Lacey described the people that she remembers, like Flat Tire the barber, Mabel Cook the beautician, and Richard Saunders the usher at the Ferguson Theater, they all seemed like vivid characters out of a great novel. Its pages were written on the side alleys and brick streets off Shrewsbury Street, where Barbara Hicks Lacey grew up. Though the buildings and people she remembers are mostly all gone, the story has not been erased. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston.
And to see photos of the Ferguson Theater and Hotel, you can visit our website, wvpublic.org. Ms. Lacey's talk was a part of a series called African American Life in Charleston, A Personal Perspective. The series wraps up this Thursday as the fourth speaker, James Estes, recalls his own memories. The event will be at 6 o'clock at the West Virginia State Archives and History Library at the Culture Center in Charleston. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Clark Davis. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.